Welcome to End of an Era, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products when you use code TFT20.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield. Seemingly immortal when at the peak of their powers, how do footballing empires and era-defining teams lose their way? Do they simply hit the metaphorical wall, or is there more to it? Sometimes these regressions can be traced and be found to have been the product of a series of events that deflects a club from the crest of a wave they are riding and towards far more stormy waters. Tonight, we bring you part one of a new series, End of an Era, which will explore where, when, and why the greatest of eras and most promising teams came to the end of one road, only to struggle to find the start of the next one.
First ball. A good break across field here by Kendall to Harvey to Morrissey. Royal and Ball at the back of the box, Whittle in the middle, there's Royal again. It's there, Joe Royal! Ten and a half minutes gone, and Everton score the goal that they have been threatening to score ever since this match began. Brown. Royal looking for it and finding it. Ball, Harvey, Whittle!
Tonight we discuss Everton and just where it went wrong after they won the 1969-70 First Division title with a team of style and substance, blessed by a midfield that was christened the School of Science, a team that provided four members of England's 1970 World Cup squad and looked set to dominate for the rest of the decade. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a new series. Before we start, I would just like to put on record that this series is the brainchild of Mr. Stephen Scragg, and Stephen is the first co-host that I would like to introduce for this new series. Stephen, welcome to another new series. Again, another one of your ideas. Kind enough to let me host.
No, you always do us proud with these series, Stu. You're the man to host them for us, and what would it be without that those surprise questions that weren't scripted? You know, it just wouldn't be the same.
I would like to say I've got some, but they usually turn up around 15, 20 minutes in, so I don't know if I've got any yet. But I'm sure I will. I'm absolutely sure I will. Looking forward to this one.
I am. I mean, it's a series that was born out of a Twitter. I can't only call it a Twitter conversation. It was a Twitter, I don't know, dissection of an era that went wrong, and it was just a fascinating conversation. Those kind of, you know, sliding doors events and just the marginal moments that can mean so much to the bigger picture, and it just kind of like sprang an idea into the mind, and I thought, you know what, that'd make a really good podcast, and sure enough, here we are.
Yeah, it's like I say, I love it when we start a new series. I absolutely love it. Now, obviously, we need another co-host before we get to our special guest for this, as is the usual format. Again, no surprise, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, how are you?
I'm good, thanks Mighty. I'm ready for a new journey. I've got my packed lunch ready and we're going to set off on a new adventure. Matt Boy, the legend that is Mr. Stephen Scragg. Yeah, looking forward to it, mate. It's going to be a great series and this is a great subject to kick off with and a guest as well. I mean, you couldn't get a better guest than the one we have today to start a new series.
Like I say, there's no real secret here that this guest that we've got tonight is always my favourite guest. Whenever we have him on, it is absolutely fascinating and knows how to tell a story. Now, obviously, we've mentioned that it's Everton 1969-1970. For regular listeners, that's probably given away who the guest is. But For those who are new, it is Mr. Paul McParland. Paul, welcome.
Welcome, Stuart. Thanks for having me on the show. Stephen, brilliant idea for the series. Gary, looking forward to some interesting conversations today. And I was kind of hoping that I'd be invited on to talk about the decline of Klopp's Liverpool, but apparently I didn't get the memo.
Well, we'll see how long the series runs. if it proves to be really popular, we may have that admission, Paul. We might even call you back for it.
We'll try and
look forward to that.
We'll try and come up with a wishful thinking series, yeah.
That's it, Stu. That's not a bad idea.
So, Paul, obviously, there's no pressure. You've got no one to follow. You're going to set the standard for the end of an era. Hopefully, episode one won't just be the end.
I feel a bit like Paul McCartney talking about the breakup of the Beatles. You know, you take me back to a painful time in my past.
Yeah, I imagine this is almost going to be a little bit of therapy for you, but that's all right. We're all here to hold your hand and we'll guide you through it. It'll be all right. So first of all, then, it's Everton. It's 69-70. It's the crest of a wave. But, you know, we need a bit more about that. A little bit, if you can just sort of set the context for us to where Everton sit in and around that sort of mid to late 60s period.
Yeah, so, I mean... Everton were known as the Mersey Millionaires at that time, backed by John Moore's lavish finances, and won the league in 62-63, won the FA Cup in 1966. And then it was a case of Carter trying to build a second team, really, to challenge for the championship towards the end of the decade. And it took a couple of seasons. Eventually, the key signing of Alan Ball after the 66 World Cup was the start of the embedding of the so-called Holy Trinity. Howard Kendall was signed after Everton beat Liverpool in the FA Cup in March 67, 1-0. And then the team started to climb the table, fifth in 67-68, third in 68-69. And then we come to the 69-70 season when all of Catrick's planning, all his hard work, getting the team together, just came to fruition for that season. And at the time, it looked like that was going to be set the standard for a few years to come. But unfortunately, as we'll talk about later, it didn't happen. So in terms of where Everton were at that stage, I mean, the 60s, no, there was no one team that was absolutely dominant in the 60s. And I'd like to Ipswich Town had won the title in the 60s. Burnley had, Manchester City had, Man United had, Leeds had, Liverpool had, Everton had. So it kept changing. But certainly at that time, if you're trying to pick out three or four teams who you could say, you know, were always contenders in that decade, then obviously Everton, Liverpool, Leeds, Man United, and towards the end of the decade, Manchester City. So they were a strong side with a massive fan base, just like their rivals across Stanley Park. And the expectation was there that the team needed to start delivering trophies again. Carrick had been seven seasons without winning the title at the start of this one. So the pressure was on, really, for finally the club to deliver and for Carrick to deliver again.
Yeah, sorry, coming to you, Stephen. We did a series not so long ago where we looked at sort of decades and we looked at managerial rivalries in decades. And I can remember you pointing out, you know, sort of as Paul did there about league winners, FA Cup winners. So I mean, that 60s and 70s period, there was, as Paul's mentioned, there was no real dominance. And it was, you know, the time was right, really, for a team almost to take hold of that era.
Yeah, as Paul said, you know, 1960s, you had, you know, eight different league title winning teams, eight different FA Cup winning clubs as well. It was just a massively open era, level playing field, and it was just a fantastically open era. You know, if you consider now kind of like the Premier League era, where there's been, you know, a hegemony, you could look at Serie A, you know, since Sampdoria won the title in Serie A in 1990-91. You know, there's only been two occurrences where the league title hasn't ended up in the possession of AC Milan, Inter Milan or Juventus. You know, there's been a loss of, you know, there's been some great football played in that time. But when you start to narrow the field of winners, then, you know, it becomes repetitive and it becomes, you know, the norm that only a small amount of teams, there's an elite that are allowed to win it. But this was an era in which, you know, anyone could rise to prominence. Ipswich won the title, you know, in the early 60s. Burnley had won it. There were some fine teams. Manchester City, you know, it might not be a surprise to people that they won it in 69, wasn't it? Yeah, they'd been a second division side not so long before that. Leeds United climbed out of the second division, won the league title. Liverpool climbed out of the second division, won the league title. This was an era where anything was possible for a team with a coherent plan and a good manager and a fantastic set of players. You know, it was truly down to, you know, the vision and the coaching. And you know, it wasn't down to checkbooks all the time. Paul states that, you know, Everton, yeah, they were the Mersey millionaires. They had more than most, but that wasn't the be-all and end-all.
I mean, you know, coming to you, Gary, I guess, you know, I'm not trying to be mean in any way, shape or form, but I guess, you know, you'll remember this Everton side. And, you know, this, as Paul also mentioned, you know, Leeds United were around at that time. Shankly was at Liverpool. And I guess, I suppose in a way, you know, I suppose younger listeners, contemporary football fans are used to sort of periods of one or two teams dominating. So you have your Man United and Arsenal. At the moment, it's Liverpool, Man City. But back then, it must have been not a time of excitement, but almost there must have been a competitive edge to the games week in, week out.
There was indeed. The domination by clubs is, I would say, a relatively new phenomenon because it's happened in the past. But in this sort of time period we're talking, there wasn't a dominant club. There were lots of clubs that were competitive. And as you say, you know, it was a time, you know, I say exciting, but, you know, you didn't know who was going to win it. You could pick. It's going to be one of six or seven, but to say one of six or seven is you know, is pretty open tournament, and that was the case. And when Everton won the title, 69-70, they won it by 9 points. You know, I mean, that's that as things go in that sort of era, that was a pretty dominant performance, and it almost looked like, I mean, Harry Kattrick would have been at the club then for best part of a decade, if not a decade, sort of approaching a decade, and you know, you'd think, okay, everything is set now for the for them to become the dominant club, but they just didn't. And, you know, which is obviously what we're going to explore now. And it'd be interesting if Paul thought of that. I mean, I was doing a bit of research on this earlier today, and Harry Kattrick was one of the sort of the last of the managers who stayed at the club for a long time. He was there for, 12 or 13 years. And you almost think when you look at how the club fell away afterwards, had he been there too soon? I mean, I don't know. It'd be interesting to talk about that as we go along.
It's I mean, you know, like I say, we've got the right person on for this, and it is, you know, it's something that we do really want to get into. And obviously, that, you know, managers, when is it the right time to go? You know, sometimes we talk about not enough loyalty being in football, but sometimes, you know, clubs can be too loyal almost. So Paul, you know, they've won the league title, the close season, you know, leading into the 70-71 season. What's the vibe like at Goodison? You know, is there any inclination of what's to come, or is it a complete blindside?
Yeah, I don't think there was really any inclination of what's to come. I mean, you go back to, you know, Gary mentioned there, the team won the title by 9 points, you know, which was a massive total at that time. They were also the earliest winners of Division One as it was then, because the season was curtailed to finish by the end of April to help England in the World Cup. After Everton had won the league, I think Alan Ball came out with the quote, "This team is certain to go better. How can it fail?" I think Harry Carter made a few quotes like, you know, "This team's yet to reach its full potential." So all the messages coming out of Goodison were that Everton were on track to continue that success in 70-71. When you look at the age profile of the team, so the holy trinity of Alan Ball, Colin Harvey and Howard Kendall. Ball was 25, Harvey was 25, Kendall was 24, at their peak footballing years, with many years hopefully ahead of them to come. The leading scorer, Joe Royal, was 21. Alan Whistle, who'd been a substitute towards the end of the season, was in his early 20s as well, and contributed like 10 goals in the running to help clinch the title. So there was youth in the team combined with experience. So it seemed all the ingredients were there to continue the success at the start of 70-71. Now, there were a couple of concerns that Harry Kattrick in particular had. Kattrick was a manager who, like a lot of managers in the 60s, hated the international call-ups. He just felt they disrupted the team, they turned players' heads, and he was never happy when any of his team was selected to play for England. I mean, there was a famous story when Tony Kaye was at the club in 1963 and Kaye came into his office and Kattrick says, "Tony, I've got good and bad news. What do you want first?" He said, "Well, give me the good news. Good news is you've been picked to play for England against Brazil next week. What's the bad news?" "I'm telling them that you're injured and you can't play." So he absolutely hated anyone playing he hated anyone playing for their country. Now, he was really concerned about the South America experience because he felt with Everton having four players going to Mexico in terms of a Brian LeBone, Alan Ball, Tommy Rice, and Keith Newton, that it was going to be a massive demand on them to recover at the start of the new season. Now, I think what was quite surprising was that the Catterick didn't buy any extra players during that close season. I think at the time that was a concern amongst Everton fans. Certainly when they'd won the league in 62-63, Catterick failed to bring in reinforcements that summer, with the result that the team didn't defend their title successfully. So that was kind of in the back of people's minds. And as he probably acknowledged that some players were going to come back feeling the strain after the World Cup, it was strange that he didn't move in the market to bring in some additional squad players to try and you know, cover for any potential injuries and the like that would happen during the season. Now, another thing that happened was at the start of the season, Everton played the Charity Shield away against Chelsea. Sorry to bring this up, Gary. And Everton won 2-1. Now, Catterick might have thought after seeing that game, well, things are okay here, I don't need to do anything. Now, that was a stark contrast to the Charity Shield in 66-67, when Everton played Liverpool and he lost 1-0 at Goodison Park. And straight after that game, Catterick went out to bring in Alan Ball. Obviously, Alan Ball had a massive, massive impact at Everton. So there were a number of factors there. Certainly, the World Cup was a massive factor for Everton. The failure to bring in reinforcements was a massive factor for Everton. Obviously, like lots of teams, you have to deal with injuries, etc. And Everton didn't quite have the squad to deal with their injuries. And they made a really poor start to that season, which I'm sure we'll talk about a bit later. But there were a number of factors beyond the club's control. And the World Cup, certainly, those four players were never the same that season as what they were the season before. I mean, I think just in contrast, I mean, Alan Ball had scored 10 goals in the championship winning season. He scored 2 goals the following season. It gives you an idea of the impact the World Cup had had on the Everton team.
It's a great point, actually. You know, it's something that I've not considered. And I guess, I'll speak to you about this, Gary. But, you know, if you think, I suppose thinking back what Paul said there, you have the World Cup in 66 was obviously in England. So, you know, minimal travel. You then have the World Cup across in Mexico, the heat, the exhaustion in 70. There's no qualification 74, no qualification in 78. The World Cup is back in Europe in Spain in 82. So it's 86. So, you know, there's actually this huge fallow period for English football and club football where, you know, players don't have to recover quite as much. And, you know, I suppose it's a really interesting point that Paul makes there, that the impact that World Cup in 1970 in Mexico had on, I guess, a number of clubs. But obviously, in particular, it was certainly pertinent to Everton based on how they'd finished the season before.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, actually. I mean, I was looking at, you know, as I was doing research this afternoon, as I mentioned earlier, I never thought about that. It never struck me. And I guess probably the reason why is because, I guess, in a squad of 22 players, there's going to be, you know, out of the four players, I don't know how many other clubs had but there must have been, obviously, it's an England World Cup squad, the top players are going to be there, so there's logically, they're going to be from the top clubs. And if Everton had finished fourth or third the following season or fifth, and I'd say, yeah, okay. But that it was a cataclysmic tumble down to mid-table, 14th, or I think it was 14th they finished this. And I can't think that can be. I'm sure there's an element of a factor being there, but it seems to be something, must have been something more than just a World Cup hangover. You probably start off players coming back and feeling a little bit jaded and emotionally drained as well as physically drained from the World Cup, and especially the heat and the flight and the distance and that sort of thing. But yeah, I mean, there must have been something else. I mean, I don't know what it is, but there must have been something else as well, I would think.
Oh, don't worry, we'll find out what it is, Gary. Don't worry, I'm sure Paul will be all over this. But obviously, before we start looking at Everton's form, you know, at the start of that season, you know, Stephen, I've gone off script here. I'm really sorry. I can see why you've picked this series. Just thinking there, as you know, as we were discussing the World Cup with Paul and Gary. But you know, we're not going to be able to lay the blame of Mexico 70 for every single episode of this. So there's going to be, you know, it's going to be fascinating for some of these incidentals, as you like to call them, which is a great word. The incidentals that actually trigger some of these demises.
Yeah, I mean, it's the imponderables, isn't it? It's the concept of being able to see something that's going to happen, you know, two steps before it does. You know, that's where it comes down to for me. You know, you can look at someone like Brian Lebone, for instance, there, who was so pivotal for Everton at the time. And, you know, he went to Mexico with England for the World Cup finals. Yeah, you know, he walked away from that. And then I think he only played about 20 odd more league games in an Everton shirt beyond that. And while you couldn't have predicted that, he was, well, he must have been about 30 at the time. So he's at an age where, I mean, even going to the 1980s, I think people used to class a player as being like 29, 30, as being over the edge a little bit. You know, so for that to be the case in the early 1970s, I think, you know, you're looking at something like that and saying, well, maybe Carrick should have been looking at least a long-term successor to a player like that. But yeah, it is. It comes down to a lot of those, you know, slight kind of like it's just the blindsiding moments that can make such a big difference.
It's like I say, the series is going to be absolutely fascinating. So I suppose, you know, coming back to you, Paul, you know, we have the World Cup hangover, if you like, and going into Everton's early season form, you know, how does it start for them?
Yeah, I mean, just go back to what Steve said there before. It's a really good point about Brian Lebone that Stephen made there, because as you might well know, in the 66 World Cup, Brian Lebone was in the Alf's final squad, the 27, before it got narrowed down to 22, and he withdrew from that squad because he, for personal reasons. And you do wonder, you know, sliding doors moves, if he decided to withdraw from the 70 World Cup squad, whether that would have prolonged his career, because as Stephen rightly points out, he had quite a shortened career after that World Cup. And also, don't forget, Everton's keeper Gordon West was being trialled to be the backup keeper for Mexico in 1970. He went to the game in the Azteca in 68, was going to be in Alf's original squad, and then Gordon West pulled out as well. And it's one of the great footballing debates of what may have happened if Gordon West had been the backup keeper instead of Peter Benassi in 1970 against West Germany. There could have been a different outcome. Who knows? Anyway, going back to what you asked me there, Stuart. Yeah, I think, I mean, Gary made a really good point there about you can't blame it all on the tiredness, and you can't, that's correct, but it certainly impacted on Everton's start to the season. Now, other teams had players in the World Cup. I think Leeds had four players in that World Cup squad, but they brought in Joe Jordan, so they brought in some extra cover. And I think Everton's start was they didn't win any of the first six games. Now, for defending champions, that's an absolutely abysmal start, probably on a par with Ipswich, you know, after they won the title. Now, I think Everton's first home game that season was against Arsenal, who the season before, you know, were 12th on the table and then came to win the double that season. And you might be aware that was the first season that Bob Wilson presented Football Focus, I believe. And his first home game, Everton's first home game, was against Arsenal. It was a 2-2 draw. And when Everton got their second equaliser, Wilson recalled on Football Focus the following Saturday, when he went to get the ball out of the net, some wag from the crowd shouted, "Make sure you play that one back on Saturday, will you, Bob?" So, it was a bit of a moment in history there as well for Everton in that respect. But going back to the start of the season, after six games, we were in 20th position, which, you know, it was beyond belief, really. And all that kept the season going at that stage was the European Cup run. And that was really the only bit of optimism for the fans, because it'd just been a very, very underwhelming start. And Carrick seemed to be at a loss how to deal with it and how to get the side back on track. And I think, I mean, during the course of the season, Everton never made it to the top half of the table at any stage during that season, apart from a one-week spell, I think, in October. So it was just a catastrophic campaign from start to finish. And for a team of such skill and such ability to kind of implode like that, it is still very, very mystifying. Obviously, the World Cup was a factor. Maybe certain, like Aaron Whistle in particular, although he'd had a tremendous end to the 69-70 season, wasn't the same player in 70-71. The goals dried up in 70-71 compared to 69-70. Joe Royal wasn't as prolific. So when you look at some of the key elements of that side, ball scored on less goals from midfield, Royal scored on less goals from up front, they all kind of combined. In addition to that, Cassock had made his change to the captaincy. He'd taken the captaincy. Brian Abouma had been captain until he was injured in 69-70. Ball took over on the running. So impressed was Cassock with Ball as a captain that he kept him on as the full-time captain the next season. Now, Alan Ball was a very good captain, but some players found him a bit too demanding at times, and there were rumours of training ground conflicts and players being unhappy the way he spoke to them because he'd be quite critical of players' performance in training, etc. So there were a few factors combining there to explain why the side wasn't doing as well as what they should be doing.
Just before I go to Stephen Paul, just a personal question. With regards to sort of this season then, and you know, you talk about not winning for the first six games, the Everton fans in terms of patience, obviously coming off the back of a league championship, I just wonder how much grace was given to the side with regards to the, you know, as you say, you know, almost catastrophic start to the league campaign. When did it, the unrest start to happen?
I think the unrest was more towards the end of the season. I think we'll talk about that a bit later, Stu. But certainly most Everton fans, if you asked them that season, what was their priority? The priority was quite simply the European Cup, because don't forget that summer, the European Cup was due to be played at Wembley. Now, as Man United have found out in 1968, playing a European Cup final in your home country is a massive advantage. So although they were disappointed with the home league form, with the general performance of the team across that campaign, there was still, because they kept the European Cup run going, that kept the fans' interest there. And once January 1971 came about, we had the FA Cup run as well. So there were two major distractions to the league form. So there was, although there were murmurings, as you always get, no matter how successful you are, of discontent about tactics, players, etc., I think most of the fans were given the club grace, thinking, well, we can settle for not winning the league this season if we come away with the European Cup instead, or even better, if we come away with the European Cup and FA Cup double. And that was still a distinct possibility until the end of March 1971.
Yeah, we'll come to those days.
You do have to.
Stephen, yeah, really sorry. It's the key part of this whole episode. So, you know, Stephen, it's, you know, winning league titles, that, you know, it's crucial how you start, how you set the tone. Those, you know, as Paul mentioned it, those first six games, you know, it really does set a tone. You know, if you're a reigning, and you'll know this as a Liverpool fan, Gary will know it as a Chelsea fan of more modern era, but you know, if the league title winners hit the ground running, it's almost a lot of the hard work is done for you in that upcoming campaign based on what you did last season and the form coming into this season as well.
Yeah, you get a different type of pressure as you know, once you're at the top, it's one thing getting to the top, it's another thing staying there. That's the classic phrase. And yeah, it's a very difficult thing to do. It gives you a whole new set of challenges, because you, whoever you play next, they're coming at you, where they're coming at you from the perspective of, we're playing against the champions and we want to raise our game against them. And it is a very, very difficult thing to do. So whether you're reigning champions or not, or you finished mid-table the previous season and you're launching into a new campaign, you know, the tone is set within those first formative months of the season. You know, a league title aspirations can be sunk within September, October at times, and this was the case for Everton. But as Paul says, you know, the European Cup was just such a huge thing for them, and never downplay what the FA Cup meant. Up until about 25 years ago, it was absolutely huge. So, you know, the league campaign wasn't the be-all and end-all. The fact was that, you know, teams could win a league title, and like Everton would do this season, finish in 14th place. You know, it could work the opposite way around as well, because like when Arsenal were the league winners this season, they only finished in mid-table in 69-70. So it could go the opposite way. So, I doubt at that time people would think that one poor league season would mean that would stretch for like half a decade or a decade. You know, a new season would start, and given the fact that it could be quite volatile, finishing first, then 14th, or finishing 10th and then finishing first, that the new season that would follow, you know, it was a clean slate and you just went again. I don't think that teams probably took as much baggage from the previous season into a new season that they tend to do in contemporary terms.
It's an interesting point, actually. And Gary, I suppose, you know, expanding on that further with regards to, European Cup success, and, you know, and I appreciate this is about, you know, this is about Everton, and I'm really sorry, Paul, on the decline of Everton in this particular period. But, you know, with you, Gary, with Chelsea, when Mourinho comes and wins the Premier League, did you as a Chelsea fan feel that, well, actually, you know, as Stephen's kind of mentioned there, you know, it's a clean slate, but actually, you know, the year of the Champions League is arguably more important. That's where we'll determine whether or not this season will be a success.
That's a good question. That is, it's a massively good question. I think. I mean, you got a reputation for it, buddy. So you know, just living for your reputation. I mean, I think the Chelsea situation is a lot different to the Everton one, in as much as we hadn't won the title for 50 years. You know, and Everton had won it a lot more recently than us, so it meant more to us, I think, because of the. Well, I mean, in my lifetime, God, I was knocking on by then. But I think Steve made a really good point there about the baggage from the previous year. And we shouldn't forget that we're talking about, and we mentioned this earlier phase in football when, you know, it was shake the dice and see what number comes up. That's who's going to win the league. And it was that changed so much so quickly. And Everton's season had something that the rest of the teams didn't have, and that was the European Cup. And it was a big thing. It was a damn big thing. But the Everton season actually was. I looked at this afternoon, and it was very strange. As Paul said, they had a bad start, but they had an even lousier finish to the season. You know, the last, I think it was, I can't remember, it was 12 or 13. I think it was 13 games. They won once and lost 9 times. I mean, you almost think, well, you know, that's. And okay, we might be in a situation where the league's gone by then, and you're going to finish mid-table, so it almost didn't matter, perhaps they're coasting. But it seems a strange, hodgepodge sort of season. And, you know, it's not you can't write it off as a one-off. And this is what Steve was saying earlier, because the following season, they finished 15th. The season after that, 17th. It wasn't a blip season. It wasn't like a bad season, finish 14th, next time we'll finish 3rd, then we might win it again, then we might be 5th, then we might be 7th. It was a fall off a cliff, basically.
I'd agree with all that, Gary. And I think that there are a few other factors there as well. I mean, I think Hattrick started to realise by the end of September that he needed to bring in some reinforcements. So one of the moves he tried to make in the transfer market was to bring Archie Gemmell into the side. Now, bearing in mind, Archie Gemmell was a Preston player at the time. Preston's manager was Alan Ball Sr. So Harry Hattrick thought he had quite a cordial relationship with Alan Ball's father. And the deal was signed, sealed and delivered. And Archie Gemmell was fully expecting to be turning out in Everton shirt the following Saturday. Unbeknownst to Hattrick, Brian Clough had decided he wanted Gemmell, and Clough turned up at Gemmell's house, slept on his doorstep overnight, and refused to leave until Gemmell signed for Derby. This put Alan Ball Sr. in a really difficult position, and he tried to contact Hattrick, but hard to believe, isn't it? He didn't have Hattrick's phone number. In the end, he got a journalist to contact Hattrick, and basically the journalist said, look, I'm sorry, Harry, Alan's here with Brian Clough. Brian Clough, yeah. Is signing Archie Gemmell. And I know Harry Hattrick had a real intense dislike of Brian Clough for the way he conducted himself there. So that was one opportunity gone in terms of bringing in reinforcements. Hattrick's next move in the transfer market was to bring in the completely unheralded Henry Newson for a club record fee at the time. And when he was bought, it was kind of the first indication that maybe Harry was losing his touch in the transfer market, because no one quite knew where Henry Newson was going to be playing in this side, and people were incredulous when, for his first few games, he played Henry Newson in midfield and put Kendall in the back four. Now, after about 6 or 7 weeks, that was patently not working, and Henry Newton was then shifted out to play left back, which wasn't his position. So there were quite a few missteps there from Hattrick in terms of trying to get the team back on track that I think had a big influence as well. And I think just to have Gary's point there as well, yeah, that's right. I mean, Everton's end of the season was awful. The start of the season was awful. There were little spells during the season, particularly in the cups when things clicked. And I think what became apparent was, compared to 69-70, where the team performed consistently, in 70-71, you had a team that could raise itself for big games, cup matches, European games, but couldn't perform week in, week out. And I think that was a fundamental problem that Everton had that season.
Just coming back to some of those, you know, talking about, you know, transfers, injuries, you know, you mentioned earlier about the captaincy of Alan Ball, etc. And I suppose it follows on a little bit from the sort of the unrest from the fans. And again, this is a personal interest here. But in terms of within the camp, within the playing staff, Paul, when did, I'm not saying when did unrest start, but when or did questions start to arise about how Everton's season was progressing? I mean, obviously, you know, footballers are intelligent to know when it's not working, when it's not going right. But in terms of dressing room unrest, was there any dressing room unrest at all? Or did that come, you know, as we approached these sort of fateful 4 days? Up until then, was the lure and the hold of the European Cup and FA Cup keeping a lid on everything within the dressing room?
I think, yeah, if you look at things from the time that they took place, Stu, there weren't the same number of media outlets, there wasn't social media, so you didn't get to actually hear what the vibes were within the dressing room. Certainly, I think it intimated before, some of the players were getting to be quite resentful, not so much about Harry Kassick, but about Alan Ball, that they kind of felt his captaincy wasn't bringing the best out of them, that he was very too demanding on them. He was often critical of their performance. He would sometimes run back and berate defenders. I think Keith Newsome called famously one game when Everton conceded the goal against Leeds last season, Alan Ball ran back to berate him for conceding the goal. And Newton just says, well, hang on, what are you doing today? Why are you coming back to berate me? Why don't you get up there and get a goal back for us? So there was some animosity developing there between the captain and the team. Now, Harry Kassick himself, you know, was always very tolerant of Alan Ball, much more than other players. And I'm sure that even if players were complaining to the manager about Alan Ball's captaincy, he wasn't particularly doing anything about it. But to go back to your kind of original point there, and Stephen touched on this as well, it wasn't just the European Cup, it was the FA Cup that was also a massive trophy. So as long as the team were competing on those two fronts, then I think the players would probably say themselves, OK, we're not going to win the league this season, but hey, we could win the FA Cup, we could win the European Cup. I would settle for that in the circumstances. So I think it's those 4 days in March when that kind of changes a little bit.
Yeah. OK, so I'm really sorry, Paul. We have to ask. It's on the script that a Liverpool... No, the Liverpool fan has written the script. I'm really sorry. So
I realised that.
So obviously we've got it. It's Stephen's series, so we've got to do as he says. So the 4 days, you know, these 4 days in March. Then, you know, it's the European Cup quarter final. It's the FA Cup semi final. And again, if you can sort of talk as I'll say as painlessly as possible. It's clearly going to be painful. I'm really sorry, but as painlessly as possible. And I am going to have to come to Stephen and Gary for their thoughts on this as well. So this isn't going to be over quickly, I'm afraid.
Yeah, so I think most Everton fans, and you know, I mean, you can't underestimate the importance of the win over Borussia Mönchengladbach in the previous European round. What a boost that gave to the club, you know, particularly if you factor in the 1970 World Cup and losing to West Germany, to beat a West German team, you know, in the European Cup a few months afterwards was a massive boost, arguably for the country and for the club as well. So when the draw was made for the quarterfinals, Everton were paired at Panathinaikos, who, compared to who else he could have been drawn with, seemed quite a favourable tie. The only kind of vague, slight reservation would have been that the first leg was at home. And I think Kassick was well aware of the fact that Everton couldn't afford to concede at home. Now, from what I recall in that game, Everton absolutely battered Panathinaikos. They hit the bar, they hit the post, they had shots from all over. But it was a classic European performance from Panathinaikos. They had one break, one counter-attack, and they scored the vital away goal. And the way their players celebrated with their fans, you just felt they knew how important that goal could prove to be. Final 10 minutes, you know, it was like the storm with the Alamo, and Kassick threw on David Johnson, who was a young player coming through the ranks at that time, and he scored for Everton with almost the last kick of the game to make the game 1-1. So it wasn't the best of results, but at 1-1, Everton are still in the tie. Now, I think Everton were quite unprepared for what they were going to face in Panathinaikos, because the Greek plan had been quite simply to grind out a 0-0 draw, knowing they were going to go through. The arrangements for the trip to Panathinaikos left so much to be desired. So the day before the actual game itself, they'd been invited to a banquet courtesy of the Greek FA, where they had to wade their way through a 10-course meal, which just seems absolutely madness. They booked a hotel just on the outskirts of Athens, which meant that all evening they couldn't get to sleep because there were motorbikes whizzing past, things being thrown out the window. Everything, you know, it's what you kind of expect if you've done your homework on what this type of time was going to be like. So they were knocked out of their stride a little bit. They felt a bit uncomfortable. Of course, at the time, Greece was in charge of the military junta, you know, with the generals being in charge. So the sight of armed police was quite an unusual thing, both for Everton fans and the team as well. The pitch was absolutely awful, you know, hardly a blade of grass on it, but it suited Panathinaikos because they knew Everton had to score. They didn't. Everton players were getting spat on by the fans. Things were getting thrown at them throughout the game. They just couldn't believe how badly they'd been treated. As was not unusual at that time, the referee seemed to make a number of very questionable decisions in favour of the home outfit. And the more the game went on, it just seemed like it was slipping away from Everton. They only needed one goal, but Everton appears to be contriving against them to pull that goal back. As it came to the last 15 minutes or so, I think Kashik threw David Johnson and just said, go and do what you did in the last game, Davis. And he tried his best, but he didn't. And at the end of the game, that was it. 0-0. A massive, massive opportunity missed, because they then would have been just two games away from a European Cup final at Wembley. And I know Kashik kind of was very, very infuriated by the team's performance. Allegedly, and I'll choose my words very carefully here, went into the dressing room after the game, and the first thing he said to the players was, you bees have cost me £5,000, do you realise that? And stormed out the dressing room. Now, you know, for the players who wanted a bit of motivation, a bit of, you know, consolation, that was not what they wanted to hear. That all their manager was concerned about was losing this massive £5,000 bonus he thought he was getting for reaching the semi-final. And they kind of left Greece in quite bad spirits because of that. Now, to compound matters, when they came back to England, some of the players were unaware of the fact that they weren't going to go home to be with their families for 2 or 3 days, but the Kashik had actually booked them to be based in a hotel for 3 days. Now, Kashik himself took ill on the plane coming back from Panathinaikos, that was kind of hushed up quite a bit at the time. So the players for those 3 days weren't training with Kashik, they were just training with Wolf Dixon, I think. So, and the arrangements got even worse because the Everton players thought they had a hotel booked in Lim, Cheshire, but apparently Liverpool had beaten to that hotel and Liverpool players were staying there. So although Everton were training in Cheshire, their hotel was actually in Blackburn, so they could be using every day from a hotel in Blackburn to train in Cheshire. So that really didn't put the players in the best frame of mind. Now, Kashik's absence those 3 days cannot be underestimated. It had a massive impact on the players. Looking for, at the time when they needed leadership, they didn't have it. So when it came to the semi-final itself, Bill Shankly, as Stephen would affirm, who's a master of mind games, when he got wind that the Kashik was not going to be there present at Old Trafford for the semi-final, allegedly popped his head into the Everton dressing room and said, I tell you what, boys, they'd have had to nail down my coffin to make sure I wouldn't have been here today. And that's kind of psyched the Everton players out. We think, well, hang on, you've got a point here. You know, why can't our manager be here with us? And I think that set them on edge a little bit. Now, as for the game itself, I mean, Everton made an excellent start. You know, they took the lead through Alan Ball after 14 minutes, dominated the first half, had a few chances to get a second goal, didn't take them, were hanging on, not hanging on, were doing quite well in the second half, maintaining their lead. And then Brian LeBowen got injured, and that kind of changed the course of the game because the linchpin of Everton's defence was gone. That experience was gone. Everton's aerial power in defence was gone, which Liverpool were taking advantage of. And suddenly, from being like a team that looked as though it could see out the remainder of the game, the onus and the impetus switched to Liverpool. Now, Wolf Dixon was on the bench, brought Sandy Brown on as a substitute, and made some alterations to the team formation. Harry Castle later said that he'd been on the bench. He wouldn't have made those changes, so that might have been a factor. I'm not sure. But you know, the rest was Liverpool got two goals. I think the second goal was a header from Toshak, and it was just an awful way to end 4 days. And the players trooped off at the end of the game. The fans were distraught, and I think Joe Royal later said that was the week in Everton's history that kind of destroyed their future, because 7 days at the start of that week, they had the possibility of being in a European Cup semi-final and of being in an FA Cup final at Wembley. And within 4 days, those two massive opportunities had gone. And the following Tuesday, Everton had a home game against West Ham United. Now, bearing in mind Everton's attendance was nearly 50,000 when they won the league in 69-70. There were 29,000 for that home game against West Ham. Like 29,000, the place felt like an absolute morgue. And there was a real funeral atmosphere that enveloped the whole stadium. And you mentioned about dissatisfaction from the fans too. I mean, the fans just rose up with their feet there. Some just couldn't bear to go back into the ground after the week they just endured, those two losses. And to make matters worse, Everton lost that game 1-0. And as Gary rightly points out, the end of the season form just absolutely totally slumped off. So it was a really, really awful end to what had looked like being a very successful march for Everton, kind of just collapsed around their feet. And Steve, as it has pointed out a few times in previous podcasts, that was the week when the balance of power changed on Merseyside. Everton get to a European Cup semi-final, Everton get to an FA Cup final, then Everton's future is looking far more optimistic. But to recover from those two defeats, and particularly to recover from an FA Cup semi-final defeat to your fiercest rival, was almost like a mortal blow to Everton's heart. And, you know, and there's a case for saying that the club took 15 years to recover from that.
I'm really sorry for that, how painful that must have been. Paul, take a breath now. Stephen, you know, I'll come to you first. I mean, you know, Liverpool fan, and you know, this isn't a case of, you know, sort of supporters rubbing the nose in, you know, in opponents or, you know, derby rivals rubbing the nose in it. But I guess, you know, as Paul's mentioned there, sometimes it's really difficult to pinpoint a shift or a change in dominance. You can pick an area around it, or a season, or over a couple of seasons, or changing of players and squads, etc. But here, you know, as Paul's mentioned, you have four days where the whole landscape of a football city completely changes, and it can be pinpointed down to those 4 days.
Yeah, it can. I mean, the thing was that the day that Everton were losing out in Athens against Panathinaikos in the European Cup, Liverpool were in Munich playing the Bayern Munich of Franz Beckenbauer and Gerd Müller and Sepp Maier in the first quarter-final. And they'd won 3-0 at Anfield in the first leg and closed out the second leg with a very mature 1-1 draw for a team that was half experienced, half inexperienced. There was a lot of Liverpool players in that side that season that hadn't played much. They were roughly, some of them were roughly around the age of some of the Everton players who, you know, had massive amounts of experience. You were looking at an Everton side there. I mean, that was one of the big things looking at this earlier today for me, is that I knew the geography of it all and how it kind of panned out. But the big thing that took me aback was just how young that Everton side was. You know, so many of the players in that bracket of kind of like 20 to 25. And that was the startling thing. And a lot of those Liverpool players were in their early 20s. Clements had only just claimed the first choice goalkeeper that season. He'd come in the previous season towards the tail end. Alec Lindsay, Larry Lloyd, Brian Hall, Alan Evans, John Tashuk, Steve Highway. There was a lot of inexperience. There was a lot of players there that hadn't played a game of this magnitude before. And then you look at the Everton side, who just won the league title. You know, most of them have played in the 68 FA Cup final. Yes, they'd lost it, but the experience went a long way. You know, this was an Everton side who'd been there and done it. This was a Liverpool side that was, you know, Lawless, Smith and Callaghan aside. Peter Thompson was only on the periphery then. You know, yes, Alan Hughes had a lot of potential about him, but he'd not won anything. You know, so this was an Everton side that had everything stacked in their favour going into that game. Yet, yes, that 4 days just absolutely alters. It's like a tectonic plate almost. It's a complete shift. You know, Liverpool don't win the FA Cup that season. They don't win the First Cup that season. But that week in March kind of, it gave them a sight of what they could do, of what was capable, what was before them if they wanted to do it. Whereas for Everton, you know, those two hammer blows of going out of the European Cup, a European Cup tie that they should have bypassed and got through to the semi-finals. And, you know, an FA Cup semi-final where they should have been, or if they weren't, they certainly should have been classed as the favourites going into it, on experience levels. But yeah, that shift is absolutely massive. I'll just go back to David Johnson as well, who would later play for Liverpool, of course. You know, he got that goal against Panathinaikos in the first leg of that quarter-final for Everton. But he'd also scored like a crucial goal, the only goal of the game against Derby County in the fifth round of the FA Cup. And that's Brian Clough's Derby County, massive game. And he was a player that could have been so much for Everton during the rest of the 1970s. Yet, you know, and we'll come to it very soon, is how he was one of the players that Catterick, you know, he let go, you know, in the seasons to come.
I'm going to come to you, Gary, for, you know, clearly we have the blue half and the red half of Merseyside here dissecting 4 days of what is essentially nearly 40 years ago. But, you know, from a neutral perspective, Gary, you know, can you unpick anything within these 4 days, be it naivety, poor planning, just bad results, bad luck? You know, how, you know, to a neutral, how do these 4 days, you know, look to you?
Well, I guess it's not the 4 days, it's the little things that happen within those 4 days. And just to sort of, first thing, you know, Panathinaikos, you know, people, modern-day football fans will think, you know, a great team ain't that good. Well, you know, they got to the final, and after beating Everton, they played Red Star Belgrade and lost 4-1 in what was Yugoslavia in those days, and then defeated Red Star, a damn decent Red Star team, 3-0 at home to qualify. And only lost to Ajax in the final, you know, one of the greatest club sides of all time. So, you know, I don't think, you know, we should say that, you know, people think that Panathinaikos were a rubbish side. They weren't. But on another day, Everton go to Panathinaikos and get a goal and win. On another day, Harry Catterick, flying back from Greece, isn't ill. On another day, Brad LeBone doesn't get that injury. On another day, Everton get through to both those games. Get through to victory in both those games. And that's how close things are sometimes. You know, 4 days was just a pivotal thing. And once those two eliminations from the cup tournaments had sunk in, Everton's season was dead and buried to all effect. And, you know, and I'm sure that fed into the reason they had an extremely poor finish to the season. And the chance was gone. And it must be a deflating thing, because to be so close, and, you know, it's football's a game of fine margins. And, you know, sometimes when you flip the coin, it comes down heads four times. If you call tails each time, and that's just the way the fates are sometimes.
I knew this would be a great series. I knew it would be a fantastic episode. And, you know, we've still got a little bit to cover. You know, we're already, you know, just near the hour mark. But as always, as we discussed at the beginning, as long as we're under an hour and a half, we're good. So I suppose, Paul, we've come to the end of the season, you know, and as, you know, people have mentioned, it's, you know, you would wipe the slate clean, you'd go again the following season. But ultimately, Everton never seemed to really recover from this season for the best part of 15 years, probably.
Yeah, I think that's what I indicated before, Stuart. Yeah, and so he comes to the 71-72 season. And I mean, Gary mentioned, you know, very succinctly there about, you know, a little turning point of the previous year. 71-72, you know, the fans are starting to become a bit restless for the first time. And, you know, really, they can see that Liverpool are just starting to emerge again. to be what they were sort of from the mid-60s, and they want to be catching up with that. So they're expecting a flurry of big signings in the summer. It doesn't happen. So once again, the season does not get off to the best of starts because of that. Now, at the start of the season, Carter makes one or two changes. So he drops Andy Rankin, who'd been the regular goalkeeper for most of 70-71, who was still in 27, and brought Gordon West back into goal. Now, you could argue that, you know, Gordon West deserved his place back, but Andy Rankin then left that summer because he was so annoyed at being dropped again. He was only 27. He went on to play another 12, 13 years for Watford and Huddersfield. And given the goalkeeping problems that Everton had in the mid-70s, one wonders whether that was the right decision or not. I think Stephen mentioned before about one or two aberrations from Harry Kattik in the transfer market. I think that was arguably one of them. Everton's big summer sign that year was a left-back from Falkirk called John McLaughlin, who hardly inspired the Tellises with his hairstyle or his football. And as the season progressed, by the October half-term week, the last week in October, Everton were 19th in the table. There was just no sign of Kattik being able to unravel the way the team had disintegrated. More and more rumours are coming out about training ground disputes involving Alan Ball. And attendances have started to decline. And all of a sudden, you know, the championship-winning year almost seemed like a distant memory because there didn't seem to be any hope of Everton recovering that. There were the odd sparks of light. Everton beat Southampton 8-0 at Goodison Park that season, with, you know, 4 goals from Watford, 3 goals from Alan Ball, 1 from David Johnson. Stephen mentioned David Johnson before. A lot of hopes were being carried by Everton fans for David Johnson, because here was a guy who had scored on all his Everton debuts, his FA Cup debuts, League Cup debuts, European Cup debuts, his first derby. This guy had potential, and, you know, it kind of indicates that if he could be developed, then you'd have a bright future at the club. Injuries were starting to impact him more than 71-72. Lebone was injured. Joe Royal was injured. Certain players never quite recovered their form. Jimmy Husband was injured. So a lot of the key elements of the championship within side weren't there. They just weren't functioning. But of course, the event that most Everton fans remember was the shock announcements on Christmas, December 1971, that captain Alan Ball had been sold to Arsenal. And that was really, for most fans, it was the final nail in the coffin in terms of their respect and views for Kattik, because that was Kattik regarded, I think subsequently in a few biographies, I read Kattik regarded purely as a business decision. It was a good deal. He was getting money back on a play. He was doubling his money on a play he bought 4 years previously. But the psychological impact of the Holy Trinity being split up, with the captain going to Arsenal, it was just very, very difficult to fans to understand what the rationale was behind that. And I think, you know, most people who were watching the club then just saw that. You know, for the club who'd been known as the Mersey Millionaires in the early 60s to be selling their best asset to one of their rivals just did not make any footballing sense whatsoever. I think the 71-72 season, we end up finishing 15th that season. Gary mentioned about the end of the 70-71 season being quite catastrophic. 71-72, Everton won one game out of the last 16. This is a club in serious, serious decline, and no one appears to be getting a grip of the situation. Everton's last home game that season attracted 21,000. We haven't had gates like that since we were in Division 2 in the early 50s. So it was just a club that seems to be from top to bottom, rudderless, without leadership. And there was a quote from Alan Ball when he, in a training session where apparently he turned around to Wolf Dixon in despair and said, "How can I play with this lot? They're just not good enough. They're not as good as me. What am I supposed to do with them?" And that might have been an indicator that he'd actually sussed the situation out, that the players the club has weren't performing to the levels that they should have done. Combine that with Harry Kattik having a heart attack in January 72, and once again, you can see that, you know, the team is really struggling. And Stephen may be aware of the story, but apparently after Kattik had recovered from his heart attack and he went back to Goodison for his first training session, back to Belfield for his first training session, first person to meet him there was Bill Shankly with a cup of soup and wished him all the best, wished him a speedy recovery, and said, "Oh, by the way, Harry, any chance of me buying David Johnson and Joe Royal while I'm here?" And if those deals had gone through, I think there would be all hell to play. But and the players coming through were not of the same calibre as the players who won the league title. So you had the likes of Peter Scott, Terry Davicott coming through. And really, this was a club, it wasn't at a crossroads, it was heading up a dead end.
There's so much there. There's so many. Again, we come to incidentals. This is the whole point of this particular series. For you, Stephen, the sale of Alan Ball. I mean, there's been an undercurrent, certainly from myself, who is not a fan of football on Merseyside. There's been this undercurrent of Alan Ball, wonderful player. Everton fans loved him, but obviously, Paul's mentioned, the slight unrest, there's issues with how he talks to other players and maybe treats other players. And I just wonder whether the sale of Alan Ball is, in your opinion, looked upon, not as an excuse, but is it because of the club that he went to? Is it because he went, or is there a little bit of naivety there that actually it was a good, and I don't want to upset any Everton fans or Paul because I still need some more information. But the sale of Alan Ball, is too much put on it, I suppose, based on what's happened and what Paul's talked us through, is too much emphasis put on there on the sale of Alan Ball?
No, I don't think you can put too much emphasis on the sale of Alan Ball in this situation. Is that, he was a player still clearly at the peak of his powers, and he was the best player at the club. Now, as Paul's mentioned, the fact that he was rubbing players up the wrong way, he maybe took his captaincy, too seriously. We've heard of players before of the problem about a player like Alan Ball is that, and it was always an accusation levelled at Roy Keane as well, was that there would be a frustration if the players around them weren't of his standard. Then it wasn't a case of any understanding there. They just cannot understand why, other players can't do what they can do. They don't get the concept of footballing mortality, that people are kind of like, they're not the immortals that an Alan Ball or a Roy Keane is. And if you cannot match their standards, then if there's a lack of understanding there and a lack of tolerance, then it's going to cause a rift within the squad. And this is what it sounds like with Alan Ball on the outside looking into me. It looks like Alan Ball fell foul of a personality clash with his manager, and the managers thought, let's just cut our losses a bit here, let's cash in and maybe try and rebuild something else. But within that, from the point of view of the manager, that's very short-sighted. If you're looking to attract a better class of player, then selling your star man isn't going to persuade players to come in. If you're, you're Everton and you've just finished in 14th place, you're heading towards 15th place in 72, and you go and sell your best player, that's not a selling aspect for potential suitors of bringing players in. It was a self-defeating. So in that respect, it's quite self-defeating in selling Alan Ball. You try to meet in the middle. You surely try and talk him down from that respect. You maybe turn around and say, do you know what? Maybe just hand back in the captain's armband. Enjoy playing again, and then let's see where we go from there. I think a similar type of thing happened at Liverpool, where Phil Thompson had the captaincy taken off him and it was handed to Graeme Souness, but it didn't mean the end of his time at Liverpool. He played on for another few years, and it just comes down to man management, and given that Catrick's suffering with ill health, his tolerance levels would have dropped dramatically. And I think what it sounds like there to me is that there is a lack of an intermediary. On the side of Ball, he's not tolerant of players not being up to his standard, his teammates not being up to his standard. Whereas for Catterick, he's got to a point where, can I really do with this fight? And he's thought different of it and sanctioned the sale to Arsenal.
We'll come to Catterick, you know, leaving the club and the potential replacements that were bandied about. But before we do that, Gary, just coming to you, you know, and it's something we talked about, you know, quite early on in this discussion, and you know, the sort of the loyalty that, you know, a lot of people say doesn't exist in football at the moment. But sometimes there is just the odd occasion where actually, you know, clubs can be too loyal, managers can be too loyal to certain players, chairman can be too loyal to the managers. Do you think this is a case in point here where perhaps Everton and Catterick's relationship went on just too long?
Yeah, I do. I absolutely do. I think what Stevie says about Alan Ball, and yeah, I take a slightly different view. I mean, I'm sort of old enough to remember these sort of events pretty clearly, and I don't think Ball was the problem. I think Ball leaving was a symptom of the problem. The problem was that the team were falling apart. They weren't successful. Ball, like every top player, wanted to succeed. And if you can imagine, you know, Stevie put a comparison with Roy Keane. If you can imagine Roy Keane playing for Manchester United and then being 17th in the league, you can imagine what's going to happen there. But the season, I mean, Paul mentioned a couple of minutes ago about they only won one game in the last 16. It was away at Southampton. Their away form, Everton's away form, was by far the worst in the entire division. They only won one away game all season. They only scored 9 goals in 21 away games. The 9 goals they scored was far and away the worst in the league. The bottom team, Huddersfield, scored 15. The team that scored Nottingham Forest scored 22. They're away form. Now, okay, you know, there's lots of reasons for that, but you know, it just strikes me that when you need people to dig in and you need a heart and fight, away games are where it's exposed the most. And to me, the symptom was Ball leaving, not the problem. That was the outcome of the problem that was already there.
You know, as we come to wind this up, Paul, I guess, you know, Catterick leaves, you know, towards the end, 72-73 season. And, you know, the managers that, you know, I mean, Everton is, you know, was still a big club, you know, relatively recent champions, European Cup quarterfinals, so on and so on. So, you know, and in particular, obviously, Don Revie's name, who had been incredibly successful up until this point with Leeds United, is heavily linked with the club.
Yeah, I mean, just if we just go back to Catterick leaving the club before going to Don Revie, Stu. So I think a couple of things definitely did for Catterick in that 72-73 season. One was the sale of David Johnson to Ipswich Town, which Everton fans just saw as one of their brightest prospects being taken away from them, in exchange for Rod Belfers of Leeds, who, along with Bernie Rice, who we know that Gary knows quite well, was possibly Catterick's worst signings during his managerial career at Goodison. Second thing that season was the FA Cup defeat at home to second division Millwall by 2-0. I remember the atmosphere of that game, and it was, you know, it was poisonous. Fans were just, you know, were spilling bile in the comments towards Catterick. So the club had no choice but to make that move. And Gary was right, I think, in terms of loyalty to Catterick. I think John Moores had always been eternally grateful to Catterick for the fact he brought him in. He delivered 2 league championships, he delivered an FA Cup, and he did feel a bond with Harry Catterick and was desperately hoping that Catterick would turn it around, but sadly he didn't. So you come to that close season, and as you outlined there, Stuart, Everton are an attractive prospect. You've got John Moore's money still backing the club. You've got a massive fan base ready to come back to the stadium. You've got a stadium that is one of the best grounds in the country, which hosted the 1966 World Cup semi-final. The infrastructure is there. The fan base is there. Everton are an attractive proposition. What was quite bemusing for most Everton fans was Everton's first shortlist of 4 managers, and amazingly, Don Revie, with his track record, wasn't top. 3 of the names that had been mentioned were Jimmy Armfield, who had yet to prove himself in the top division despite his success at Bolton Wanderers, Bill McGarry, no idea how he got on that list, and Bobby Robson. Now, you know, Bobby Robson has developed a reputation over the years as a bit of a ditherer, and he certainly dithered when this job offer came around. But of course, Bobby Robson at that time wasn't the Bobby Robson with the reputation he had by the end of the decade. So even his appointment would have been a bit of a gamble. So they went for Don Revie. Now, this kind of all came about because Northern Ireland couldn't play their games in the province during the times of the Troubles at certain periods. So their game against England was relocated to Goodison Park. One of the match commentators for ITV on that day was Don Revy. And at the end of the game, John Walls approached him for a bit of a chat about prospects and made it quite clear that, you know, if Don was interested in the Everton position, then Everton would be prepared to look at offering him a decent contract and salary. Now, I think Don Revy, and maybe you might know more about this than me, Stuart, living on that side of the Pennines, often fell out with the Leeds board over salaries, felt he was underappreciated, felt he wasn't being rewarded. And there's no doubt that Revy looked at Everton, looked at the crowds Everton was still getting compared to Leeds, and must have thought, yeah, this looks good. Everton were going to offer him a fabulous salary, much more than what he was going to earn at Leeds. So, you know, Don had a reputation of being quite money motivated, and so he was certainly very interested and tempted by this. The following week, I mean, bear in mind that John Moores was quite a successful businessman. I don't understand how he didn't send the car to collect Don Revy to bring him down for a discussion, but Don Revy's car was seen asking for directions in Freshfield, where John Moores lived. The person he asked for directions at a zebra crossing was an Everton fan who got straight on the phone to Liverpool Echo to say, "I've just met Don Revy. He's on his way to John Moores' house." So the story kind of broke. Then the details kind of came out about the offer that he was going to get a £50,000 signing on fee. He was going to be paid £150,000 over 5 years. Now, bearing in mind, the average salary for a coal miner was £2,000 a year at that time. You can see what mega books he was on. And from what you read in the Leeds United biographies, he'd gone back and told the players he was going. He was taking the Everton job. Apparently, he told Norman Hunter and Trevor Cherry that they would be his first two signings for Everton. So Everton was set up for him to make that move across to Goodison. Except for Dennis Skinner, because at the time, the Conservative government had a pay restraint policy. And one of the conditions of the pay restraint policy was that somebody taking over somebody else's job couldn't earn more than £500 a year more than the previous person. Obviously, the salary Everton were offering Don Revy broke that completely. So a young Dennis Skinner raised the matter in the Houses of Parliament, and it's on record in Hansard's. And he asked the Conservative Minister, I think a Mr. Chichester Clark, would the Government Pay Committee be investigating the salary that had been offered by Everton to Don Revy? The reply was yes, they would be investigating that salary. 2 days later, Don Revy, having found out that the money on offer from Everton was no longer there, and in fact, he wouldn't actually be getting a pay increase by transferring from Leeds to Everton, told Everton he was no longer interested in the post. So, Everton's history once again twists on a question in the House of Commons from a certain Dennis Skinner.
Brilliant. This is why you're my favourite guest to have on, Paul. It absolutely is. Stephen, you know, just, I suppose before we finish, then it's worth contemplating. You know, it's the idea of a series we've knocked around for a bit and may well still come to fruition. But you know, the what if moments. Don Revy at Everton. How would you have seen that fit?
Oh, it's one of those great imponderables, isn't it? You know, who knows, as we've discussed here, by the time, you know, Revy potentially becomes the Everton manager, it's a very different Everton to the one that's won the league title in 1970. You know, would it be a case of him being able to build a new dynasty at Everton, or would it be akin to something like him taking on the England job as he did a year later? You know, would he have gelled somewhere else? You know, It's one of those great what ifs, isn't it? It's one of those great what ifs. But yeah, going back to that contract that was, you know, reportedly offered to him, there was talk of kind of like a £50,000 signing on fee. There was, you know, by the time that they'd have paid out on compensation to Leeds and the duration of the contract that was being mooted, you know, there was talk of that being worth up to £250,000. Which, you know, 1973, you're talking about an investment of £250,000 to take Don Revy to Goodison, then I think had it gone through, then it would have had to have worked.
I mean, just quickly coming back to you, Paul, you know, a Don Revy Everton, how would that have inspired you?
Well, I mean, that is such a fascinating topic, and you could probably do a whole show on those shoes, to be honest. But I think you have to look at the context of the times, because I think we mentioned this before in previous podcasts. So at the end of that 72-73 season, Busby's been moved upstairs at Man United. Alisson and Mercer have left Man City. Shankly is one season away from leaving Liverpool. Bill Nicholson is on the verge of leaving Tottenham. Brian Clough has left Derby County. So suddenly the managerial landscape has changed completely. Now, you know, so if Revy takes that job, he's in a situation where some of his main managerial rivals have either left or will be gone within 12 months. And you just wonder, if he had taken charge of Everton, whether that would have been sort of that fortuitous moment in time to take that club forward. Now, when you think Revy stayed with Leeds, and Leeds won the title in 73-74, playing some of the best football that had been seen from a Leeds United team, but from teams in England anyway. So he definitely still had this. He still had the wherewithal. And I know Gary wrote about Revy's tribulations with the in his book, Cheers, Tears and Jeers, hope I've got that right, Gary, about how he struggled to work in the international setup. But I think the club setup of Goodison is a different call to managing England. And I think if he brought in some of his key Leeds loyalists, then the situation could have been far, far different for Everton. And yeah, it's one of those what-if questions, isn't it? And of course, I think I mentioned this before, lots of Everton fans at the time who named their house would often name their house not Rev, because it was Everton spelled backwards. And after Revy turned them down, a few of them woke up in the morning to find some of their red neighbours to change that wording to not Revy.
Brilliant. Gary, you know, I suppose, you know, a final sort of question for you as well. In terms of, you know, I'm one for legacy. We talk about legacy a lot. And, you know, obviously, you know, Catrick oversees, you know, the most wonderful of highs for Everton Football Club, but is also there during the most, you know, some of the most significant lows, and lows that actually go on to have a long-term detrimental effect on the club. But in terms of his legacy as an Everton manager, how do you see it?
Well, obviously, of his time when, you know, up to the sort of tail end of the 60s, you know, he was exceptional. I mean, clearly exceptional. And I think Everton fans will always remember him fondly. And it's always a sad thing when a manager stays too long. As I think this was the case with Catrick, be it because of ill health or be it because of player dissent or whatever. The Revy thing is an interesting one to contemplate. I mean, how the hell did Dennis Skinner know about that deal? I mean, he must have somebody on the Leeds board or something. But if Revy had gone there, you know, I just think, you know, Everton were 16th or 17th in the league. That would have been a massive turnaround. And Don Revy has only ever succeeded in one job at Leeds United. He's never succeeded anywhere else. I mean, I don't know, you know, how people look at it, and perhaps he would have, you know, they've got vast potential at Everton, and but if Don Revy had gone to Everton, Howard Kendall may not have done. Now, for Everton fans, you know, the renaissance under Kendall, the following decade was massive. You know, they were certainly the best club in the country, may even have been the best club in Europe, certainly one of the best clubs in Europe, and the Everton fans wouldn't have had that potential if Revy had gone to Everton. So we talk about legacy and how these things turn out, you know, sliding doors moments, as Stevie mentions quite often, how things could have been different, and they may not have been better, they just would have been different.
Wonderfully put, Gary. Wonderfully put. Paul, obviously, you know, you're the guest. It's your club. It's sort of your story, if you like. And I guess, you know, final thoughts lie with you. And, you know, as Gary's just alluded to there, you know, very, very painful times for Everton Football Club. But does that make, you know, what's to come with Howard Kendall? Yes, it's 15 years later, and it, you know, it must feel like a long time when you are a supporter of that club. But does it make, you know, the Howard Kendall years all the more sweeter as an Everton fan?
Well, I think any success is sweeter, isn't it, Stuart? You know, I think looking at Harry Kassick's legacy, you know, you think Everton hadn't won a trophy since 1939. So when he delivered the league title in 1963, that was Everton's first trophy in 24 years. You know, during his time in charge, you know, he turned the side that, don't forget, spent three seasons in the second division in the early 50s. He created a side that played an invigorating brand of football. They won two league titles. They won an FA Cup. I think as a manager, Harry Kassick earned more top division points in the 60s than any of his rival managers. So his legacy cannot be questioned. Yeah, and he would kind of set the bar for all the managers who came in his footsteps to follow. That just cannot be taken away. And he deserves his place in kind of like the pantheon of Everton managerial greats, and that just cannot be taken away from him. And I think as well, he was a tough act to follow. I think Gary made the point there. He probably stayed too long. He probably did. And one thing you could accuse John Moores of was not having a succession plan in place. So maybe... I think Alan Ball made a comment in an interview a few years afterwards saying he'd wished Everton had appointed a tracksuit type manager like a Malcolm Allison type to take over after Kassick had left, and maybe the success could have been continued with a more modern, younger manager. It's another one of these kind of what-if scenarios. But, you know, as an Everton fan, obviously I'd always be eternally grateful for the success that Harry Kassick brought to the club. He made the club headline news again because, I mean, don't forget in the 50s, neither Everton or Liverpool were headline news. You know, they both had spells in the second division at that time. So he made them a force again in the 60s, and he delivered Everton's sixth and seventh league titles. So he deserves his place there. And I think Steve has mentioned before as well that although Everton's demise in the 70s was quite severe, compared to other clubs, we actually got quite lucky. Man United got relegated, Man City got relegated, Leeds got relegated, Derby County got relegated, Tottenham Hotspur got relegated. Everton avoided that. So that's one small crumb of comfort that can be taken from that dismal decade.
I didn't really want to finish it like that, but I'm afraid we're going to have to. But if that's the crumb of comfort, Paul, that helps you sleep at night, that's fine. If that's how we're going to end this sorry tale, then that's fine. That works for me. Paul, it's been brilliant. I knew it would be. It's been, you know, as always, certainly in education myself, it's always fascinating listening to you discuss any subject with regards to football, but even more so when it's your own club.
Well, thanks, Stu, and thanks once again for the questions. You know, I have been in training sessions now with top interviewers to make sure I can deal with them, so I hope the training's paid off.
It was excellent, yeah. Everybody answered all my questions tonight. It's been brilliant.
Yeah, I lose about £5 in weight every time I do these.
It's like I even had a discussion with Stephen today, just double checking that he was okay with me hosting it. Like I say, I love it. It's the best job by a mile.
No, you're brilliant, Stu. I mean, you've been the best out of all the guests. You give us all a chance to speak. You tolerate all interruptions and interjections. And you know, as I say, the thinking man's Jeff Stelling.
Brilliant. Stephen, happy with episode one?
Oh, great. You couldn't have asked for a better start there. You know, a fantastic guest, you know, a brilliant topic. This will be the benchmark by which all the others are going to be wanting to emulate, basically.
I think, yeah, hopefully this should see us get the series commissioned now. Now this pilot can go to Omar, hopefully we can get this commissioned.
Yeah.
Gary, as always, you know, you were there, you lived it. It's always a very good perspective from you. Have you enjoyed this trip down, I won't say misery lane for Everton, although that's not what it was about, but was it interesting to reminisce over this period?
It was, and it's always great because, I mean, you know, if you're not intrinsically involved with a club or, you know, you don't sort of see things on the inside, so it's great to listen to people like Paul who have got so much inside information or, you know, local information about the club and things that I wasn't aware of. I mean, they didn't skin anything, but I mean, you know, oh my God, the beast of Bolsover has devoured Everton's aspirations of getting done River. It's been great fun. It always is talking with guests like Paul, and you know, as I said earlier, the series is a great idea, and if he's the pilot, take off time, guys.
Fingers crossed. all that's left for me to say, you know, is once again, thanks, guys. Also, thanks to the listeners. And as we say, fingers crossed, please, please join us again, certainly on the Lob podcast with these Football Times, but also when we'll be discussing the end of another club's era. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.